Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Tantandia products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. We are familiar with the concept of taking holidays off, but we find it alien and disorienting. How are you doing, Walker?
And repulsive.
Repulsive. That's a bit strong.
Feeling much better, Mark. Had a nice little vacation there,
yep.
And now all is better.
And now you're feeling very judgy about people who take time off?
Exactly.
Yeah.
How dare they?
We support people taking time off. It's just not something we do as a general rule. Walker had to be wrestled to the ground to keep him from recording last week, but we think Jimbo did an admirable...
Adequate, I think is the word you're looking for.
Yeah, I see. I started with admirable, and then there was nowhere to go. Yeah. No, in all seriousness, we're very grateful, and it was good that you got some rest, and we are now ready to engage in our customary blend of nonsense.
Okay, here we go.
So, we are going to be doing catch-up this week, so there's not going to be a topic or a feature game. We're going to do the as-yet-unnamed retrospective intro segment, the Eurus.
And then we're going to, since it's the end of the year's coming up, and we're going to have our big list. We're going to go through every game that we played this year and do a slight brief summary of what it's about so we can like gear up for our big list. Is that not what that's what I'm
I don't have for. 8 hours to record, Walker. This is why the people at Board Game Barrage know to split things up when they're going to be talking about, you know, 50 games apiece.
We've got to do it all at once, Mark. Just bang it all out there and then we're done. We don't have to worry about it. Now we're going to talk about the plethora of
games. Is this the time to do a mom joke? Is that, would that get us, would that run afoul of age listing? Okay. We're then going to do the games we played last week, although for Walker it's going to be 2 weeks.
It's true.
And then some brief new segments, and then we're going to get out of here, and we are not going to do that madness that you talked about.
Our holiday extravaganza show.
Yeah. So on that topic, we are going to talk about what we reviewed last year. Walker, what did we review last year?
Exactly 1 year ago, we reviewed Station Fall. It is this very unique type game where there are a plethora, 25 or more different characters, and a lot of them, do all of them show up every game?
No. You only play with a subset of them. You do a fixed sort of either scenario set or whatever.
So there'll be a subset of characters, and you don't know who's playing who. You have two characters that you're sort of moving around, and you sort of decide on which one's going to be your main one halfway through the game. And they do all sorts of other things, from releasing giant aliens to shutting down the engines to starting the countdown timer for self-destruction to flying around the outside of the ship to getting to the escape pods. All sorts of craziness ensues. It is a fantastic game, and we should get it to the table this holiday season, I think.
Really? I was thinking the opposite. A friend of mine was mentioning a man I'll call Il Lupo was talking about having played Station Fall, and I was reminded that I don't have any interest in revisiting it. I've got some fond memories. It's not terrible. It's just the you know, this expression is the juice worth the squeeze. And when the rules explanation is probably going to take you an hour, and you're still going to leave things out. Like, for example, I explained how to play Station Fall probably at least three times leading up to reviewing it with various different groups, because you need a large player count, and it's a whole thing. And frequently I would leave out something like firebombs. How do firebombs work? How do you make a firebomb? How do you throw a firebomb? What does a firebomb do after you throw it? Under what circumstances can you throw a firebomb? Because technically you're not really allowed to murder people in some context. Are the lights on? Are the lights on? If the lights are on, is there a witness? What's a witness? Anyway, so I was reminded of all that. And sometimes you get these interesting moments, but at the end of the day,
I just say, you know, as you're going through stuff, I'm wondering, you know, am I looking through, you know, rose-colored glasses? Am I just remembering the fun bits and not the, you know, all of that, you know, guilty or not guilty, you know, swaying back and forth?
I'd forgotten about that part too. Yeah, look, it is a very interesting, somewhat iconoclastic design, right? But there's a particular style of game, rules heavy, full of chaos, lots of weird things happening, frequently where at the end of the game you're like, oh, I guess this person won? Fascinating. But in terms of dramatic reveals or lots of interesting intrigue that goes on, that was one area, I think, in particular, where Station Fall failed to deliver. Like, it was usually pretty clear who was who by midway through the game, because you need to start dragging them around the station so they can fulfill their victory conditions. And so it's not a whole lot of, oh, are they playing a reverse double blind? Are they activating this character so I think they'll... Because the risk of that is just too high. Like, we've talked about this. This goes back a long time. Like, Age of Gods. You remember Age of Gods? So you can try, that was the troops on a map fantasy game where you were gods and it wasn't clear who worshipped you over the course of the game, and you had a limited opportunity to do attacks.
It was a great game. It was like there was this huge, weird waterlogged sale or whatever where you could pick up copies for $5. It was a very interesting little game.
Yeah, and Age of Gods did the same sort of thing, and the problem was in many player counts... As you get to higher player counts and lower player counts, you didn't have this problem. You never wanted to waste your turn doing anything other than with a race that was you knew was in the can for you, because that might be spending one of your valuable actions, not only just trying to misdirect people and not advancing your victory conditions, but actively advancing the victory conditions of another player at random around the table. And the Station Fall has the same issue. Why would you bother, certainly once the mid-game starts, in my experience, engaging in this kind of intrigue when you're just handing points to somebody else?
Sure. Luckily, some of the missions, though, don't have to be accomplished by the character themselves, like releasing the creature or shutting down the engines. It doesn't have to be done by that character. So you could, you know, hijack somebody else's character and run them out to do it. And then there is also a plethora of characters that need to do that, too. So, like you said, you could be helping somebody else, but there are ways to sort of obfuscate who you are playing.
Okay, fair enough. And good use of the term obfuscate, by the way. Yeah, I mean, look, I enjoyed it. I'm happy to have experienced it. As I say, it's borderline iconoclastic. But if you tell me that you want to play a high chaos, high interaction game that leads to some wild moments of reveal and drama, I mean, there are games that do that. Door of the Lesser Houses does that. Cosmic Encounter does that, although nobody in this immediate group will play Cosmic Encounter with me. And they have rules loads that are roughly... no exaggeration, 1/5 that of Station Fall. So I'm glad you've played it. I don't have any particular reason to go back to it. I do have some fond memories, but that's about it.
That's about it. You've talked me out of it, for sure.
Well, I'm glad we agree. So that's Station Fall. That is what we reviewed last year. We're now going to move on to the games we played last week. Walker, it's been 2 weeks for you. What have you been playing over the course of the past 2 weeks?
We were lucky enough to get Tiny Mini Golf back to the table. This is sort of a roll and write mini putt game where you're designing courses for the person on your left to shoot through, and so you're rolling the dice and you're picking a subset of the dice, you know, you're grouping together in a bunch of walls or a bunch of water hazards or a bunch of sand traps. So you have to pick one of those groups and you draw it out on your little grid, you make your little mini putt hole, and you have several rounds of doing that, and then you pass it to the person that is actually going to play the hole, and then you get to do two rounds of them. They get to add more stuff. So sometimes they're forced. Sometimes I had it, in the case that we played it, I had to actually make the hole more difficult.
Really?
Just because of the only places I could place the things. But you have these two turns where you can pick things to help you out. Well, there was the two turns. One turn did help me out. The second turn made it more difficult.
Huh. Wild. You couldn't just find a place to stick like one spot of sand or one spot of water that where it would never be consequential?
It was either in the path or if I overshot, it would have caused a problem.
Oh. Oh, well.
It didn't happen, so that's fine. Anyway, so once you've designed the whole course and then you're there's another set of dice that you're rolling to, you know, move the ball around the course and you're just trying to get the lowest score compared to how long it takes the person that's playing your hole to finish their hole. And then, you know, the subset of the two scores is what you're going to get.
Now, I just want to stress, because our listeners are a sophisticated group, all right? You're not going to engage in the kind of nonsense that people around the table did. We're going to be using words like ball, and we're going to be using words like hole, and we're going to keep it professional, and we're going to keep it mature. Are we going to keep it mature, Walker?
Yeah, of course. Just like when we played. It was very upstanding and adult-like conversations.
Okay, adult can mean different things in different contexts. Anyway, moving on. Yeah, so this is a print and play that I pledged for immediately when I saw the concept. We talked about it on Pledge of Indifference. And I'm a massive fan of this design. You engage in a weird kind of spatial puzzle to build a hole that is as challenging as possible. And the line between really hard and then trivially easy is very narrow, right? Because you're trying to lay up these sand traps and these water traps, and there are rules about how there has to be an uninterrupted path between the ball and the hole that you're designing the course. You can't just, you know, enclose the hole in impenetrable walls and water traps and say, ha-ha, I've designed a deviation. So in theory, there has to be a straight line, but you want the straight line to be as circuitous and as fraught as possible. And for whatever reason, it is the kind of spatial puzzle that I enjoy. I think it's because you design it piecemeal. It's step by step. It's every round. You're like, okay, how do I make it a little more circuitous than it was before? If you told me these are all the tools you have available and do it all at once, I'd probably hate it. I'd probably find it way, way, way too daunting. As it is just the cleverness and the conceit and how joyous the theme is. Who doesn't love mini-putt?
It's, exactly.
I mean, I hate all sports, but mini-putt I'll make an exception for. And ultimately, the fact that, you know, you're designing a course for somebody else, and then the person to your right is designing a course for you, and your score is the delta between the number of strokes that you took to complete your hole and the number of strokes that the person you designed the hole for needed. So you want to make a difficult course and satisfy yours as quickly as possible. The only downside to Tiny Mini Golf is that you either have to use a freely available app to use the custom dice, because there are a bunch of custom dice required, both for the rolling phase and for the golf phase. But if you know the Hanwerker and if you know Louis, they will print out the STLs for the custom dice. And then you've got the only thing I'm lacking to make it the perfect tiny mini golf experience is I don't have a laminator. And so I do have to print out new map sheets every time, which is fine. Cause I do have a printer. I think I'm one of the last people in North America to have a printer.
Weird.
Yeah, people don't have printers anymore. It's wild. Back in my day,
you take a few sheets down to the local Staples and they'll laminate them up for you.
That is probably true. Anyway, I should probably do that. Tiny Mini Golf is joyous. We had 6 people to play, and there are a variety of different ways you can do the hole resolution part. In practice, the designer recommends that you do not do it the way we did. We just did it sequentially, one person after another, all of us watching everyone complete their holes. I kind of liked it, even though it, you know, it considerably added to the time. It was still reasonably quick, and then we got to appreciate all the different holes that people have designed and watch everyone go through it. So
it is a bit tricky, the way that you count the stroke. Sometimes people are getting a little confused about what constitutes a space and what doesn't. So it's good to like watch them do it.
Yeah, the additional clarity was also very helpful. Anyway, it's been far too long since we played Tiny Mini Golf. I have to think that the fact that it doesn't have its own box is also a bit of a reason why it's harder to remember to bring it back. In point of fact, over the course of the day, I initially suggested, like, oh, we could play Tiny Mini Golf. We then played something quick. And then it's like, yeah. And so we were listing what we would do next. I'm like, yeah, and there's Tiny Mini Golf. And everyone's like, yeah, let's do that. I forgot it was there. So I don't know what it is. It's a bit of a mental barrier, but I'm a huge fan of Tiny Mini Golf.
Well, in the Discord, I saw some like pretty fancy print and play boxes being made. So you need to step up and do a box for it.
I didn't get into this hobby for arts and crafts, Walker.
And that is Tiny Mini Golf, designed by Camillus Kaminsky and self-published.
Yeah. Camilla.
Next up, we also got to play together Green Team Wins. You know, it is the time. We had 6 players that day, so lots of party-type games. Green Team never fails to win. Always fantastic questions. and we can put this out in the Discord too. What kind of mini, small frog-like pet would you like to have?
No, not frog-like. Let's get it.
Frog-sized.
The size of a small frog. Yes.
Either a mini T-Rex, a mini Bigfoot, or a mini Loch Ness. I'm not going to soil the well with any of my banter.
Neither will
about
I.
Which is obviously the correct choice.
Everyone at the table immediately thought that there was one right answer to this question. Whether you wanted a small frog-sized T-Rex, small frog-sized Bigfoot, or small frog-sized Loch Ness monster. Everyone was certain that they had the right answer. Five people gave the same answer. Walker gave a sixth answer and then proceeded to, again, we're not going to say who did what, but then there was some, I think the only way to classify it is some b-hole in terms of your ridiculous justifications for your choice.
That is a mistake.
So comment on the video.
This being said, before the options were given, we did a consensus afterwards, and everyone was definitely picking the house hippo. Remember, there was that Canadian video of the house hippo, fantastic little video. Everyone obviously was going to pick the house hippo. That was not an option, though.
Do you know what is actually genuinely sad that you bring that up? I don't think you could do that today. If you did the same video, those of you who are familiar, it was this fake ad. It was like an ad for like the Canadian house hippo, and it was this doctored video of a hippo that was roughly the size of like a rat or a mouse or something, like going around like in someone's living room. If you did that today, you would immediately have a large proportion of the population convinced that it was real, and anyone trying to tell them that it didn't exist would just be part of some sort of media elite trying to cover it up. And now I'm sad. You've made me sad.
I'm trying to wonder what was that ad for? I can't remember now. I think it was just a wildlife ad, I think.
I think it was it wasn't a Heritage Minute because they don't engage in weird cryptozoology in the Heritage Minutes. Anyway, we're going to have to look this up.
We'll have to look it up.
Anyway, so please either comment or show up in the Discord or on the Guild and let us know what you think the answer is to that question on Green Team Wins.
Well, look for I'll put an official voting survey up.
Okay.
Look for the survey, cast your vote. And that's Green Team Wins, designed by Nathan Thornton and put out by 25th Century Games. Always a holiday classic.
So just rounding out some of the quick games that we played Flip 7. And Walker is very enthusiastic about dealing for Flip 7. It seems like it makes you the most happiest thing imaginable.
It is. I like pushing people to push the limits. I'm good at talking them into flipping another card.
Oh, but that part you can do while playing the game in any context. I feel like I was engaging in more bullying behavior than you were.
I suppose. But you just crest the top of the card. This is definitely the 11 that you want.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. Flip 7 bills itself as the greatest card game of all time, which is definitely some lovely hyperbole. It is just pure press your luck, no broader context involved. You could probably engage in some mild card counting if you really wanted to, but that would probably be overkill. I frankly think that as a spectacle, it's fine, but I think that there are better fillers to be had, honestly, because I'm going to complain about the luck of the draw. It's just there are some cards that are, it's one thing that a 12 is worth 12 points, but there are 12 of them in the deck, and so you're more likely to bust with them. But then there's just the second chance cards and the freeze cards. The freeze cards are you point at somebody, they're out of the round. The second chance cards are just great. They're just gravy. The second chance cards mean you don't have to play the game.
And then the times two card.
Yeah, so it's a little bit too much. I mean, the ones that add to your final score but don't count towards the possibility of busting, like there are ones that just give you more points at the end of the round, like +8 or +10 or whatever, that's fine. The times two and the second chance, I think, kind of kill it because then it's just you're not pressing your luck as much. You're not playing the game. They're just being, you have fewer choices and less tension. And so consequently, I think that Flip 7 even fails on its own terms. Failure is strong, but those cards definitely undermine the experience, I think.
Well, the time it takes to play and like the zero teaching time, I think still bring it up to like a great. And I think it's very welcoming to everyone as opposed to.
Great, I think, is too strong. It's fine. I'm not going to say not to play it, but I think that in terms of bone simple fillers, you can do better. And I'm not going to object, but I think that your enthusiasm is largely largely based on the joy you have in...
Mark, it is the greatest game of all time.
That's what it says.
And it's designed by Eric Olson and put out by OP Games. That is Flip 7. Always forget the actual rule for the name of the game. every time I teach it. It's like, oh, yeah. If you get to 7, then, you know, that ends the round and you get more points.
It is the firebomb of flip 7. Yeah, often forgotten. Got to play The Loop again. The Loop is a cooperative time travel themed game designed by Maxime Rambourg and Théo Rivière. Théo Rivière is actually going to show up again in this episode, and so I'm actually finding his output to be definitely worth a second look whenever I see it. And this was published by Pandasaurus Games, and it's got a lovely cartoonish style, and you're trying to grapple with the evil time machinations of Dr. Foe going to different time periods. Now, thematically, it tells a good story in terms of the setup, but you don't actually feel it. I'm still waiting for a time travel game that feels like time travel. It doesn't feel like time travel. You're just moving around a map. The fact that it's a radial map and there are different time periods, you don't ever really feel it. But the thing that really communicates the joy of The Loop is, number one, there's a lovely little tower that you get to drop cubes into, and I'm a sucker for dropping cubes into tower. It's a lovely little toy. It's a very small element of the game. It's not a huge, visually impressive thing, but it's fun to ditch cubes into a tower. And the artifact cards. Mostly what you're going to be doing in The Loop is activating these artifacts, and they have relatively simple effects, but they are very charming. So it can be fantastical elements like Excalibur, or it could be some sort of weird virus that was bioengineered in the future, or it could be magical underpants, or a techno-organic mohawk that a character has. It's extraordinarily well done. It's very simple, very straightforward, but extraordinarily engaging. I'm a massive fan of The Loop so far. The second time we played was, again, on the sort of basic level scenario, sabotage. The other scenarios add on other things you have to do in order to win. And the first game we played, it was actually kind of down to the wire. It wasn't particularly hard, but there was a fair amount of uncertainty as to whether we were going to pull it off. The second game we played was a raffle stomp. You weren't there for that one, but it was just a complete and total cakewalk. Still enjoyable, but now I'm definitely willing to start adding in some of those extra modules introduced in the later scenarios just to bring up the difficulty level a little bit. And so it's a crowded field of co-op games, but The Loop, by virtue of both its visual appeal and, you know, the subtle thematic hooks, definitely elevate it. And so it's been a very surprise discovery of the past little while. That is The Loop.
Let's go back to Civolution, because you and Jimbo already talked about it, and I also played in that game, and I'd like to talk about Civolution.
Absolutely, that is your prerogative.
There is a ton of things to enjoy about Civolution. I really like the cards, how they have a thematic presence, how they sort of build this tiered system where they're worth more points the more you fill. And if you fill each row, you get extra stuff. And all the actions you get to do also thematic ties throughout all of those. You know, like traversing through the landscape, creating more people, doing stuff. Unfortunately, all of these things are buckled down to this dice system that is handcuffy and painful to interact with. And people will say, well, just, you know, look at the dice you have and do something else. It's like, well, I don't want to do something else, you see, because this is going to score this round mark. And so I want to do that this round, but I can't do that this round because my dice said no.
Yeah, it's an awkward combination of strategic planning and timing prioritizations, coupled with, as you say, a very restrictive dice placement system.
Yeah, so it's got this, you know, particular goals that you have to do every round, much like Gaia Project. So you can look ahead and see what's coming up. So sure, you can plan ahead for the future ones, but the future ones aren't worth very many points. And I was thinking earlier today, I'm wondering if these goals are just a fool's dream. Maybe just ignore those and concentrate more on the other ways to score points. I'm wondering if that's the key. It might be even more fun if you just ignore those and concentrate more on building your tableau up. Maybe you'll find the same number of points there and find it a little bit more fulfilling because you can adjust more with how your dice are. I am not sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. As is transparently evident, both from the final scores and from the overall structure of playing Civolution, the skill ceiling is very, very high. I'm not going to claim that, oh, well, you know, I mastered it, and so that's why I don't want to go back. There's absolutely room for improvement. And you may be right. It may be more advantageous to just ignore the short-term goals and just ride the dice as best as possible. But then we have two problems, both related to complexity. Number one, the short-term goals then are just unnecessary cruft. And number two, if the proper way to play, if the ideal way to play Civolution is to be more reactive to what the dice tell you, well then, why play such a heavy game when at the end of the day, your actions are more or less dictated by the random results anyhow? And so there's a whole bunch of stuff in Civolution that I don't think quite plays to its strengths or fit together particularly well. And in other words, it's another Stefan Feld design. His design idiom doesn't fundamentally appeal to me, certainly of the past little while. I commented before that I quite like Notre Dame and In the Year of the Dragon, some of his earlier designs, but just the stuff that he's been putting out for the past few years, it tends to feel just kind of soulless and not particularly rewarding and usually a little heavier than it needs to be. But I think your observation, you made an observation immediately after, though, which is something that you do. You said the same thing after we played Innovations of the South Tigris, Inventors of the South Tigris, the one with translation. You asked a rhetorical question. Do you remember what it was?
What did we just do? Or, you know, what are we trying to do? Is that what it was? I've forgotten already.
So the specific formulation, which I think is brilliant, is what about this is fun?
Yeah, what about this is fun? Well, I found the cards coming, you know, the cards, like building your tableau and seeing what the cards did. But that's the other problem, is that you see cards that you want, but you don't have the dice to get those cards. And those cards will either, someone else is going to take the card you want, or those cards are going to be covered up. It's all under a time limit. Got to get those cards before they disappear. Got to get these goals done before it's the next round. Lots of things that are time constraint, and then you are handcuffed with these dice. Anyway, Civolution, designed by Stefan Feld.
Played another game of Iron Forest. I raved previously about the engineering of Iron Forest. It is a dexterity game with these lovely little mechs that are basically the same pieces as the penguins from Ice School, except now they are mechs instead of penguins. Obvious possible expansion, Mecha Penguins.
I'm surprised it didn't ship with that expansion already. Really.
Yeah, that's a pack-in expansion if there ever was one. And they have these launchers to throw it up to this lovely multi-tiered board that is very, very tall. It has a marvelous table presence. And if the launchers didn't work, the game wouldn't work. But the launchers work perfectly. It is the kind of thing where you can get to the second level almost 100% of the time. You won't necessarily get exactly to where you want to. That is where the additional skill comes in. And that's exactly the balance I want in things like that.
And the second level is so high. Like, they made it so you can get your hands underneath. There is no limitation to making your shots on the first level by the height of the second level. It does not get in the way. They've made it ridiculously high.
It's so high, you wouldn't believe it. And the big downside to Iron Forest thus far is that it's a fixed four-player game with teams. But fixed four-player games with teams, you can play with two players, no problem. And so I played it two players with Ilupo, and it was glorious. I didn't know how we felt about dexterity games. You always have to be careful about hobbyist gamers. You don't, sometimes they might think that it's a baby game for babies.
Poo-poo.
Yeah.
I don't play with those kinds of toys.
Exactly.
They're only big boy toys.
Precisely. So Iron Forest was great. It is scenario driven. The first scenario is just, these are the gates you need to get through. These are the holes you need to get through. And then when you've collected all of those, then your opponent is going to set up five more things you need to get to. First two gets it. But the additional stuff you get that you don't get at the free-for-all is you now care a lot more about damaging opponent mechs. You care a lot more about knocking them out of commission, not because it causes them to lose turns, but because you get these one-shot power-up cards that are great. And so I felt like it was a lot more substantial than the free-for-all version that you and I played with Huey. And I wish it were more player flexible, because, again, we play an awful lot with three or five, and it is designed to be played with two or four. And so that's the biggest downside I've got with Iron Forest. As it is, I think it is a marvelously engineered, marvelously calibrated, marvelously designed dexterity game. And it is a great use of components, and it is something that I very, very much want to play, and I want to see more of the scenarios, and I just want to see more of the modules and see more of the cool stuff that comes, because just experiencing the marvelous toys is already enough of a joy, and they've made a solid game on top of it. And that's really what you want out of a top-tier dexterity game. That's Iron Forest by Brian Gomez, published by Brain Games, pursuant to successful crowdfunding.
I'm going to talk about Windmill Valley. This is designed by Danny Garcia, the same designer as Barcelona, and it is a great midweight game. you're like, you are creating this tableau that are, that is these two windmills that are interlocked, and you are turning the windmills to these two actions, and you get to choose one of the actions. And a lot of them, the ones that you upgrade, because you're constantly upgrading these, feels a lot like Crusaders. You know how you're, you know, manipulating your rondelle? Much like that. You're buying all these upgrades that you get to slot into these nice, you know, triple layered windmill boards that are, and you get to manipulate this through this sort of awkward water system where you're, you know, raising the water or lowering the water. And this is going to tell you how far you can turn your windmill. So you turn your windmill, you pick what your ever actions you are. And if you have these plus symbols, you get to do both, all in the pursuit of planting tulips. And so you're planting these rows and columns of tulips, trying to get points. We played a two-player. That's why I wanted to bring it up. It just played so smoothly and quickly and well with two players. You're just getting goal cards, planting tulips, upgrading your thing. Game's over. Tally your score. And it was great fun. Glad I got it back to the table. Really glad I picked up Windmill Valley.
Yeah, based on your comments and Huey's comments about it, I'm very much inclined to give it a try.
It's very light, but still, I think, very enjoyable.
You had me at gears. Played another game of Dragons Down. Dragons Down is the kind of reimagining of Magic Realm.
Oh, I was hoping that that was sort of like an a fantasy implementation of Black Hawk Down. That would be kind of fun. You know, adventurers on a dragon, it goes down. They have to, like, you know, crawl up inside it and have a defensive position about all these orcs. This stuff writes itself, Mark. This is fantastic.
I'm going to ignore the obvious problematic racial overtones going on there, and I'm going to keep talking about Dragons Down. So my first experience with Dragons Down, we played sort of the introductory scenario with one terrain set, and my suspicion was that if you add another terrain set, all that that's going to do is just make a bigger map, not necessarily change the dynamics of what you're doing, and sure enough, that was the case. There's more there, but you're doing more of the same. And ultimately, this is a hex-based adventure game. So basically, it's Mage Knight. And that's hardly surprising because at the time of Mage Knight's release, a lot of people compared it to Magic Realm. Now, there's not a whole lot to compare it other than, again, hex-based tiles and fantasy adventure game. But most
complexity, maybe.
That's exactly what I was about to say. In terms of complexity, up till that point, there had been long and somewhat involved fantasy games like your Talismans, but they were pretty simple and straightforward in terms of the fundamental mechanisms. But Magic Realm and Mage Knight were both games where you had to grapple with things. And back when Mage Knight was released, board games were a lot simpler than they are now. The market has moved a lot over the course of the past 10 years. I was commenting about this in the context of Race for the Galaxy. Back when Race for the Galaxy was released, teaching it was a bit of a burden. And when I reintroduced it to a bunch of people, a couple weeks ago, it's like, oh, rules explanation's done. No questions? We're all good? All right, let's go. Anyway, Dragons Down is strange. It captures some of the interesting puzzly elements of Magic Realm about figuring out what you can do and how this combat is going to shake out. And to its credit, it gets rid of the thing of Magic Realm that I hate the most, which is not the rules complexity. The thing that I hate the most about Magic Realm is all the things you just can't do. So one of the ways you can try to win Magic Realm is to go and get great treasures. But many great treasures are heavy or tremendous in weight. And you cannot carry things unless you're able to play a movement chit of the weight of the object or higher. A lot of characters don't have heavy or tremendous movement chits. And so they just don't get to be treasure hunters in the same way. And on top of that, there's a whole bunch of limitations about, oh, you just can't, flatly unable to do that thing. And then someone might be inclined to ask, well, how do I go get better movement chits? The answer is, well, I guess you could buy a horse, or at best, try to go find a treasure that gives you new chits. But that's kind of a circular problem, isn't it? Anyway, for all my love of Magic Realm, there's a lot that's just gatekept behind, you know, just flatly, you just can't do that. A lot of random stuff where it happens where it's like, oh, you found this incredibly valuable thing, you can't carry it, though. You found this incredibly valuable thing, you can't use it, though. It's just not. But Dragon's Zone also gets rid of one of the things that I think helps make Magic Realm sing, and that is natives. There are these indigenous groups to the Magic Realm that you can interact with and buy and sell things from. That part, it's kept. There are merchants that you can buy and sell things from, but you could hire them. And hirelings round out the experience of Magic Realm in a way that Dragons Down doesn't have. And this leads to my biggest criticism of the experience, and that is that no one thing is very dangerous in Dragons Down. Like a treasure guardian showed up, and confronted somebody who had not yet upgraded any of their core competencies. And they were able to win the combat without taking any wounds. Other than they technically wounded a couple things, but that's just how spells work. And I found that pretty unsatisfying. Like, there was no particular reason to run from this guardian, because I looked at it and said, oh, I can kill it.
Sounds nasty.
And then there's what will actually kill you, which is volume. It's kind of a joke, actually, that in Magic Realm, a group of giant bats will eviscerate almost anybody. You know, you show up and you're the White Knight or the Black Knight, you're heavily armored, you've got a good weapon, you figure, no problem. Oh, no, they're going to kill you. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, you can only target one thing at a time. And bats are hard to hit, and on top of they're just going to grind you down into oblivion. Dragon's Den has the same dynamic. You can only ever target one thing in a round. And if you've got a bunch of small, fast things, you can't run away. They're hard to hit, and they're going to grind you down. So sure enough, these characters that can kill tremendous dragons that show up and individually, or murder a titan that shows up one at a time, or the death knight that shows up to confront you. Three kobolds? Oh, that's going to be tough. And that's a weird thing thematically. It's a weird thing in terms of satisfaction, especially since the three kobolds might show up in a random spawn. You know, you just wander around the overland, you roll the monster dice. It's like, oh, great, here are four goblins. I can kill any one of them, probably, but the four of them together, that's a bit rough. So ultimately, I found it kind of unsatisfying, because on top of that, there's just not a whole lot to do. You raid treasure locations, you fight monsters. Those are the two things you do in Dragon's Den. And while the combat puzzle is fun, and the basic contours of the map are kind of interesting, I felt like it, in simplifying Magic Realm and making it more straightforward, you lose a lot of the nonsense charm. I'm not going to defend Magic Realm as a quality game, but I think that in streamlining it, they showed that at its core, Magic Realm gets by because of those sharp edges, not in spite of its sharp edges.
I was going to say, because there's lots of things that already, you know, simplify Magic Realm. Why, you know what I mean? Why couple it in with things that they already have?
I would dispute that characterization. Mage Knight is compared to Magic Realm, but they're not very similar mechanically.
Well, what I'm trying to say is that Magic Realm should stay Magic Realm, because that's what it is. It's a highly complex, odd-type game. You know, why change it into something else that, you know, there might be already a bunch of?
Sure. I mean, the design remit of Dragon's Den is it's still very complicated. It is more like Magic Realm than anything else. And the idea was to get rid of... So for one thing that it does absolutely successfully is it gets rid of the burdensome setup. Setup in Dragon's Den is much, much easier than the setup for Magic Realm, because Magic Realm, you had to put out like 20 different piles of chits in their specific setup boxes, and that's even before you're actually setting up the game. That's just prepping the setup sheet. So it's much simpler in that respect. And so I admire that part. But ultimately, I feel like, personally, Dragon's Den loses a lot of its personality. It felt a lot more mechanical, a lot more rote. I felt like there was less to do, less interesting things to discover than in a game of Magic Realm. And so ultimately, it left me feeling cold. Mechanically, I think it's still very interesting. And I think that if you find Magic Realm interesting as a mechanical project, as a mechanical puzzle, you might want to take a look at Dragon's Den just to see how they've done it. But ultimately, I don't have a particular enthusiasm for going back. So, interesting experiment. Glad it was done. But I don't think I'll be going back to Dragon's Den, certainly not by my suggestion. So that's designed by Scott Damaris and published by Mr. B Games. Now a brief break to pay some bills.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Want to keep your personal number private but still stay connected? With Line 2, you can get a second phone line right on your device with a super simple app and no need for another phone. Whether it's for online shopping, dating, or shielding your main number from spam, Line 2 is an easy way to manage it all. ready for peace of mind without breaking the bank? Call, text, block, and more for only $9.99. Get started with line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in any app store today. Line 2, your second line simplified.
And we're back.
Let's talk about the stuff that we've streamed. So 2 weeks ago, we streamed White Castle Matcha. Love White Castle. Like, even when I was rereading the rules so I could teach it again, I was like, oh, man, why don't we play this more? You have this tableau full of meeples that you need to populate in all sorts of different areas, and they're going to score you points. The more meeples you get out in either the gardens or into the castle or into the different areas, the more points you're going to get. And the Matcha expansion just adds more of that. Now you're putting them in gardens and stuff. My example was, White Castle is like a fight in a phone booth. You have like 9 rounds. So with the expansion, they made the phone booth a little bit bigger, but added 5 more people. So now you have geishas that you're trying to get out. Anyway, lots to love about the expansion. It's just more White Castle. So now you're getting a few more turns, more stuff to do. White Castle is just great.
Now I'm having this image of a bunch of geishas trying to get into a phone booth and you trying to kick them out.
Yes, just so. So it's this interesting dice system where you have all these bridges of dice, and there's a high end and a low end, and you're pretty well trying to figure out your turn. I want to do a castle action. And there could be 8 different places you can do this castle action, but which is going to be the most advantageous to you? Because if you take the low die, you also get to run other things, and you need to get a white die because this castle action has to have a white die. So it's just figuring out the combination of you, how to get that castle action that you want. Anyway, hoping to play a lot more White Castle, and we played with the expansion White Castle Matcha. This week, we streamed Black Forest. This is the newest Uwe Rosenberg game from this year. You are making glass, and your glass blowers are very eager to make glass. It's got this interesting dial system. Apparently, it was in Glass Road as well, where the dials will move on their own if they have space to move. So if you have enough ingredients to make glass, well, guess what? You're making glass. You needed that sand for something else? Too bad. No more sand. They just use it all to make glass. Now you have 3 glass and no sand.
Yeah, it's simultaneously a simplification and adding a weird bit of timing complexity, but in a very, very straightforward way. Because to make glass, you need to convert a whole bunch of different resources into glass. The dial system lets you do that automatically, and it makes it much less fiddly. Instead of just cashing in 5 different things and increasing something else, you just move a dial 1 notch over. And at the same time, if you wanted to stockpile a large quantity of one of those specific resources, it makes it very difficult because you have to be very, very concerned about the order in which you get the resources. So it accomplishes a lot in very little.
Sometimes you want a big surplus of things because there's these jobs that are going to pop up around the board that you need to get to. It's like, oh, they need 8 oatmeal. It's like, okay, we're going to get there. But then I accidentally got 4 charcoal, and now my oatmeal automatically goes down because I made provisions with all of this oatmeal that I had. Anyway, great. It's a very interesting game. You're moving your pawn throughout these different villages, needing provisions to do that. You're stopping between a couple of townsfolk, doing their actions, making glass, improving your tableau by, you know, putting out more buildings. That's the mistake I think I made in this game. There's lots of these conversion buildings that you can get. And it's one of those things like, I really want this building. I looked at it. I need to get these things. And I spent, you know, it's like, well, I should do this first. And then, oh, well there's no sense, you know, this would be much more action efficient if I, you know, did these 3 things. And it was like mid-game before I even got this first building. Anyway, it was awful. Love Black Forest. Uwe Rosenberg, put out by Foreland Spiel. If you have a chance to play it, give it a chance because it even looks beautiful as well.
Did you find that the trading goods, the commodities, were more consequential this playthrough? Just
100%. They were used from turn 1.
Good stuff, because that was one of the concerns that we had after our first play. It seemed to be a little bit much ado about nothing.
Yeah, it was much more like using less provisions, right? Because you can just move tiles to where you needed them without having to move, right? It just seemed to be a lot more of that going on.
Good stuff.
That's Black Forest. If you liked it, check it out. It's on our YouTube live page. You can see us playing it there.
So, got to play Dead Cells, the roguelite board game. Now, first off, I will just point out as a pedant that I very much appreciated that they correctly identified it as roguelite rather than roguelike. There are some obnoxious people on the Earth who care about that distinction. I am one of those obnoxious people. This is designed by a lot of talent involved here. Antoine Bozat, Corentin Labras, Ludovic Moblin, and Théo Rivière. Théo Rivière, as I mentioned before, co-designer of The Loop. So this is a new design collective. They've done a couple things already. This is a collective of four French designers, although Franco-Belgian, I should say, designers who are going to be moving forward. And this is themed after the video game called Dead Cells. I don't think you have any experience with it, Walker.
Zero.
Yeah. So Dead Cells is a roguelite Metroidvania. So it's an action platformer where you eventually get upgrades that allow you to explore more of the map. And it is a game that I played a lot of and I am very, very bad at. And it's one of those things where I put in a lot of hours. I really like roguelite video games. And many of them, after putting in a fair amount of time, I get better at them. Dead Cells is not one of them. But anyway, I say this because in terms of evoking the board game, in terms of evoking the video game, rather, the board game is simultaneously very good and very bad. So in terms of in any way approximating the moment-to-moment stuff you're doing in Dead Cells, it is catastrophically removed and abstracted. It just feels absolutely nothing like it. In terms of the meta roguelite progression, it nails it real, real well with very little upkeep required on the part of the players. So, for example, in the video game, there's the process by which you start to be able to interact with more of the map, and that gives you access to previous areas you couldn't access before. In the context of the board game, when you get these runes, they go into this board with slots in them, and when you set up a subsequent session of the game, you just lay out the board, and it tells you what parts of the board, of the actual stage boards, you're able to interact with. So the setup is trivial, it remembers what you've done previously, and it just captures the sense of, well, I got this thing, and so every time going forward, I'll be able to do more with the map. Now, then there's the actual moment-to-moment gameplay. And that, I think, is where, personally, Dead Cells, the board game, really stumbles for me. What was your... As somebody with no experience with a video game, how did you like the actual gameplay of the game?
It was very boring. You have a hand of three cards. The round's going to... You know, there's three distinct rounds. And on your cards, it'll tell you what you're going to do in each round. So you have to pick one of these cards, and you're playing in front of you, and everyone will flip them up, and then you'll go through round one, then round two, and round three, depending on your cards. And it's a very basic thing. So you're probably going to do a damage, or you're going to do nothing, or you're going to pick something up. These are like the three main actions, or do your special ability. Four main actions that you're going to do. So you pick this card. I'm just wondering, maybe we're taking too long to process a turn. Maybe it's just supposed to be much, much. Maybe we're just, I don't know. I'm trying to grasp this game and what they were trying to do. I'm wondering if we're just taking too long to shoot through the different rounds. You know, damn it, you know, just do go through quickly. But this is what happens because we've already picked our cards. We can't change what's going to happen. Just blow through that and get on to the next thing, maybe. I'm not sure.
Maybe. It was awfully brisk. Now, in terms of efficiency, in terms of the way they've engineered things and the physical design, the organization, they've done a very, very good job of making sure that it's quick to set up, quick to play, while at the same time, as I say, having the sense of roguelike progression and having the runs build on previous runs and feel like you're making some progress in that sense. And, of course, there's in-game progress as well that resets when and if you lose. So when I first read about how combat was going to work and how it's got this round structure, but everyone's only ever going to play one card of three from their hand, I thought that the game was going to be borderline pointless. Dead Cells, the board game, is not borderline pointless. But I agree with you that it's not quite there. It's better than I thought it was going to be. It's way better than I thought it was going to shake out. But it's still not quite something that I would find like super engaging. The fundamental card play is just kind of dull.
Playing it solo, I'm wondering if it'd be all right, like three-handing it. But I wasn't was told if you play solo, you play one character and you just play all three of your cards?
No. The actual solo system is entirely different. But okay. If you're playing multiplayer with two players or more, you're only ever going to play three cards in a combat, flat. And so I found this very structurally interesting. Most of the time, as I said, in the context of Iron Forest, when you have fixed player count games, they tend to be four. In many ways, Dead Cells is a fixed player count of three, which is great. We're often three. And so everyone plays one card. If you play two players, then the first player plays two cards, and then the other player plays one. Initially, I thought, oh, well, that'd be better. Two cards might be more satisfying. Well, no, you're still making the same choice. You're still picking one card. It's just instead of playing that one card, you not play that one card. So you're still not making a whole lot of choices. Just one person gets to feel like they're doing more. And if you play four player, one player doesn't get to participate in the combat at all. They just make a skill check, and if they pass, they level up.
Super fun.
Well, we haven't tried it four player. Maybe.
I don't think why we would, really.
I hear you. The structure is great. The structure is also evocative, and they've done a lot with very little, but the fundamental card play leaves me so cold and uninspired. Even if we sped it up and we took half as long as we did, I don't know that I would find it particularly worth coming back to necessarily. I'm probably going to end up trying it solo, partially just because of my enthusiasm for the license. But honestly, the license doesn't even do much. You know, I look at these items, I look at these upgrades that exist in the video game, and I'm like, that doesn't... But okay. I mean, yeah, this is a thing that happens in the video game, but I don't know if they really thought that they were getting to some sort of evocation to how it felt or worked in the video game. I don't know if it's possible to really evoke what happens moment to moment in the video game. I really don't know. I mean, look, it suffers very, very badly in comparison to the other roguelite video game adaptation board game that we had this year, and that is Slay the Spire.
Yes.
To a certain extent, the comparison is unfair because Slay the Spire started as a card game.
Also true.
But ultimately, it's just not a particularly satisfying co-op experience, I've found. We've played it twice. Just doesn't... I mean, the progression's neat. It's like, oh, we're getting better, we're getting stronger, we're going farther. That's great, but ultimately, the encounters don't do anything for me.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, the production's great. Feel is all there, but just there's no decision space. It's very small.
And just to echo the Walker-like rhetorical question, at the end of a combat, win, lose, or draw, what about this was fun?
That's also true.
So that's Dead Cells, the roguelite board game, published by Scorpion Masqué. As I said, brilliant production. The organization is really, really well done. Designed by Antoine Beauzat, Quentin Lebras, Ludovic Maublanc, Thierry Rivière. I'm pretty disappointed, gotta say.
I've been playing a ton of Tidal Blades 2, Rise of the Unfolders. This is designed by Tim Elsner and Ben Elsner. Because I have three campaigns on the go, you see, Mark.
That's a lot.
And therefore, this is put out by Druid City Games. And I'm just really enjoying this. It's such a different type of dungeon crawling type game. Bright colors, totally different types of monsters, different characters, not the usual fighter tank, you know, normal D&D tropes. The story is halfway interesting. The combat system, the, you know, playing card to the Nexus, doing your things. It's very easy to two-hand. And I'm just very much enjoying it until this last scenario.
Oh, what did the last scenario do?
Let me tell you about this latest scenario. You see, one of your friends has been put into prison, and you bust into this prison.
No. One of the characters has
no.
been?
Okay. No, no, no. Just a friend.
All right.
Someone you've never heard of before, you know, a story before, just, you know, oh, yeah. All right. So you bust in, and there's all these salamander thugs. You know, it's not like an official prison. It's like gangster prison. And so there's several cells, and it comes with this side sheet of 9 squares, and you have to manipulate them around this 9 square grid by turning them and moving them around. So you create this wire combination that puts power to the different doors to open them up. But unfortunately, some of the tiles can only be accessed through different terminals. So not only do you have to move your characters to different terminals to move on this mini map, but you have to use your interact action to do it. So you only get to do this manipulation once per round, and that is turn one tile 90 degrees or move one to the left or the right. You're trying to open up all these doors, and of course, you know, you're gonna, you know, power say triangle and square, and that's going to open up the triangle and square door, you know, the two complicated doors, but it's also going to open up every triangle door and every square door. And of course, there's monsters and all of those. Then they come streaming out, and then you have to truck it over to the other console because you need the dash dash, you know, circle door open now. And it's like, oh, I worked it out. It would be 12 actions to like power everything up, so everything would be open. And so that would be two characters, 6 rounds of manipulating this minimap thing while fighting off monsters. I just don't understand it. It's like, maybe some people would find that fun, but it's like, let's take this very fun game and make it completely unfun. Well, I stopped. I will come back to it. It's like literally mid game, I was just like, no, I'm done now.
Scenario design is really, really hard. And, I looking back on Oathsworn, Gloomhaven, like the really, really successful fantasy dungeon crawl adventure-y things, it's super hard to avoid them being repetitive and at the same time not engage in overloaded, cumbersome nonsense and end up feeling like you're just trying to dress up a pick'em and deliver game. You remember the City of Kings? I appreciated the fact that the City of Kings was like, this is a fantasy adventure game. It's really a pick'em and deliver game. But you know, fantasy combat, but it's really pick'em and deliver. I respect that. I respect that far, far more than these dungeon crawl things that end up feeling like pick'em and deliver games. But yes, scenario design is super, super hard, and there's usually one or two clunkers in the bunch. I mean, one of the reasons why we haven't gone back to Fateforge Chronicles of Khan lately, which is one of the ongoing campaigns that we really want to get back to.
True.
Really, really well done game. The last scenario we played was a bit of a clunker, and so that kind of puts a damper on your enthusiasm.
Yeah, it was rough.
Well, I'm glad you're continuing to enjoy the game with arguably the worst subtitle in hobbyist board gaming of the past 5 years.
What are you talking about?
Tidal Blades.
Lies of the Unfolders. Not only are you baking, but you're also doing the laundry. It's amazing.
Well put. So those are the games that we played over the past couple weeks. We're now going to move on to the news and why it doesn't matter. And let me get started with this. I have a very, very important public service announcement. I've been consuming a lot less social media lately, probably still more than I should. And one thing that I've been seeing after cons is people show their hauls at the end of cons. You know, these are the games that I got from the con.
Started up again.
Yeah, yeah, it's the whole thing. Now, here's the thing. Kellen Lacker, friend of the show from Board Game Barrage, the Red Tank. Someday I think that Kellen Lacker should have a course on media literacy, because I think I'm somewhat cynical at times, but I hear about the things that people do in marketing, and I'm like, oh, I'm just a naive little person, and I don't know all these things. And Kellen knows a lot about some of these tricks, and he pointed out, this is, I think, a very, very important activity. I can't really do it anymore because most of the board game designers and publishers that I know on social media hate me because I'm, what's the word, abrasive and obnoxious and a terrible human being. What was I talking about? Anyway, here's the thing. If you see a picture on social media of not just some rando that you follow or your cousin Ted or whomever, but like a board game influencer that has some profile, has some clout, and they say, here's my haul from this convention or whatever, be polite, express enthusiasm, say, oh, looks nice, and ask the crucial question, which of these did you buy, right? That's the crucial question. Which of these did you purchase? Because one of the things that we hammer on about all the time here on So Very Wrong About Games is the importance of disclosure. It's not even just important from a social convention. Arguably, by the standards in America of the FTC, you're legally obliged to disclose when you get something for free for promotional purposes. And hall picks are promotional purposes. So the next time you see a hall pick, be polite, be enthusiastic. Ask them which of those they purchased.
It's only right.
I agree.
And my one bit of news is, because we talked about Green Team Wins, I was looking up Green Team Wins. Mark, there's an expansion coming out for Green Team Wins. It is the Holiday Party Pack.
Okay.
So it will be holiday-inspired questions.
I'm not enthusiastic.
One of the questions was like, which is the best cookie cutter shape? Stuff like that. We will see.
The version that you have, the 25th Century Games version, that goes to 12 players rather than the one that's available in big box retail stores that goes to 6 players, which is the orange team version of Green Team Wins.
Clearly inferior version, yes.
Yes, and sadly the one that I'm saddled with. But it does have one advantage in that it doesn't have all the super niche inside baseball hobbyist board game type questions.
It's true.
Which are not good. We end up usually... on average, we end up skipping one of them every game because it comes up as like, this is not interesting.
Yeah, I should just pull them out because that's what we do. Usually when one comes up randomly, we just replace it. So I should just like peel them out because they are, like you say, non-interesting.
They are potentially interesting if and only if everyone at the table buys a lot of crowdfunded board games. Like that's the level of hobbyist that they're pitched to, which is fine. I mean, I'm not saying that these people like us are subhuman, although maybe in our cases, arguably, we spend far too much time with Gibbons and they seem way smarter than we are. But ultimately, like even people who play a lot of hobbyist board games, like Louie, for example, or the Louie or Huey or Dewey, like they play lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of hobbyist board games. They don't pledge for a whole lot of Kickstarters. So asking them whether they'd rather have a neoprene mat or metal coins that you might get on some of these Green Team Wins cards, not an interesting question. So yeah. we end up binning them 9 times out of 10. This holiday one, arguably the same.
Already pre-ordered, but we'll see.
Sure, probably worth a shot. So that's going to do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. We really appreciate your deciding to waste some of your precious time listening to us blather on. This is what's known as a pitch for you to come back. How'd I do?
Yeah, really good. That's like, if they don't come back, I don't want to see what else we could possibly do. Like that, you could have used nattering. That's a good.
Sure.
Yeah.
Is that?
I think that's a more positive type of.
I should reach out to Kellen and ask him whether nattering or blathering is a more like marketing type word.
Agreed.
To get the good engagement. Anyway, for many people, the holidays are a joyous time. For many people, the holidays are a stressful time. And for many people, it's both. So as I've said before, self-care is an obligation. Please do practice it. Hope you have a good and safe time regardless of what you're doing. Take care of yourselves. Take care of your hobby. And thank you, Rules Explainer. Take care, everyone.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark McNeil. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information. 6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.